to what this session was going to be about today, namely the invention of America. But that phrase comes from a book by Leslie Fiedler, the critic of American culture and American literature, in which he makes the claim that many of the problems that arise in American culture, the problems that confront us as a people and that make others think us so strange, came from the peculiar fact that of all the countries in the world, America was invented before it was discovered. And what I'd like to do is take off on that today and amplify it. That is, before the white man ever hit America, a myth had developed about what was here in that land beyond the Atlantic Ocean that really still controls many of our popular myths today and explains, for instance, why so many aspects of our culture are schizophrenic and the popularity of the Western when the real West was but a very short period indeed in actual history. So I'd like to start out, first of all, by talking a little bit about myth and what myth is, so that you and I understand a common meaning, because there are 50,000 different meanings for the term myth. Then talk about three peculiar aspects of our culture, and then talk about this invention of America before the discovery of America and why that seems to me to be the controlling myth behind all of these other myths. All right, I've used myth 10 times now in my opening remarks. First of all, let's get straight what myth is. What is myth, Mike? That is a myth. What would that word mean?
Well,
this is high school classroom now.
Myth is as related to legend, possibly some roots somewhere, but more or less a story. It's been sort of passed.
A fabrication, you mean?
More or less a fabrication, but perhaps some thread of reality somewhere along the line that somebody took it as truth once upon a time, whether or not it does exist.
Exaggerated reality?
No, I would have to say beyond that, I would say less tangible. A myth is something that exaggerated reality could exist here and now, whereas a myth generally refers to something in the past.
Okay. Any other definitions, brilliant scintillating definitions of myth before? You studied myth in high school?
No, we studied Gene.
Easy out. Okay. Well, there are as many different definitions of myth. It's one of those slippery things that almost everybody defines in his own way, but I'd like to use several as a way of kind of controlling this discussion. The first definition is the one that Mike was kind of leaning toward, and maybe that's the most obvious definition of myth. That is, a myth is something which is a falsehood. It's a deceit. The myth, for instance, of women drivers, that women are all bad drivers, or the Horatio Alger myth, that if you work hard and early to bed, early to rise, and so forth, you'll become healthy, wealthy, and wise. Or the myth about men not crying. Or the myth of the invincibility of the Miami Dolphins, or these kinds of things. When you use myth in that particular context, we're talking about it as if it were a fabrication, a distortion of reality, a shorthand way of making our decisions for us. The minute, for instance, we have bought the myth of the woman driver, we don't have to analyze each woman driver ahead of us. We can swerve and avoid her. And it's sort of an easy way of coming to terms with life. Okay, myth defined in this sense, I think, is fairly clearly destructive, or at least it's very limiting. A child adopting the Horatio Alger myth is really frustrated when it doesn't turn out to be true. We deny ourselves the knowledge of many good women drivers when we adopt the myth of the woman driver, or the myth that men don't cry, and so forth and so on. But at the very opposite extreme, there's another use of myth that almost makes it truer than the facts themselves. It's this use of myth that Hawthorne is talking about in the preface to The House of the Seven Gables, where he makes a claim in that book that what he's trying to do is not tell the facts, that is, not tell whether some person is a gas station attendant or a college professor or a minister or a housewife, because that really doesn't tell the truth about the person. That is, if you look at the surface of life and tell the truth, the facts as they are, you really haven't told the truth. The real truth is what is inside a person. That is, what he is spiritually, what he is internally, what he is psychologically. So that in The Scarlet Letter, for instance, Dimmesdale is a minister. That isn't the real truth about Dimmesdale. The real truth is that he is a weakling and a sinner. So Hawthorne suggests that one of the uses of myth, or romance, as he calls it, is to somehow get beneath the surface. And in order to do that, you have to, again, going back to what Mike said, you have to somehow distort that surface. You may have to exaggerate. In order to tell the real truth, you may have to exaggerate the surface. You may have to make a person superhuman, or far above the potential of any actual human being. Hawthorne calls this the truth of the human heart. Almost any writer of romance rather than novel would probably agree with Hawthorne that somehow to tell the real truth about life, the surface has to be ripped aside and you have to go beneath. So that use one of myth, or definition one of myth, is that it's a deceit, a distortion of reality. Hawthorne's use of myth is that somehow a myth more than real life itself embodies the truth. It captures something enduring beneath the surface facts. It gives clothing to patterns which we find universal in life. The Oedipus myth, for instance, which Freud gave psychology to, but which was in existence long before that, in which Hamlet and Oedipus and a whole series of plays participate in, or the idea of the loss of innocence, which you find in all cultures. Let me read just briefly from this introduction about this use of myth. This is a particularly good statement, I think, of the use of myth as a higher kind of truth than surface truth. For myth, this writer says, and this is his definition, myth is the detector of the long, slow rhythms of human behavior that drum beneath the staccato beats of temporality. Myth sees history not as a series of isolated events, but as a continuum, a pulse that moves beneath the episodic janglings. Myth catches the constants in human action, reflects the shared identity of a woman conceiving a child, a family planting a crop, Aeneas founding a city, Milton writing an epic poem, an astronaut touching down on the moon. Mythic awareness begins with believing in what James Joyce called the grave and constant of life. Well, obviously, it seems to me that in our culture there are both kinds of myths, some which distort and prevent and limit us, and others which open a whole new reality to us beneath the surface. What I'm going to talk about today are the first kinds of myths, the popular myths that have somehow really prevented us from flowering into the kind of culture that we want to be. The kind of myths, in other words, that have distorted reality and have provided us with an endless amount of frustration. In order to do that, let me talk about the Reader's Digest and about the Western. The Reader's Digest, it seems to me, is not only by far and away the best-selling, it is millions of copies in subscriptions ahead of any other magazine in the world. It is, for 30 or so countries, the only view they have of America. So consequently, the picture that people have in many countries of America is really the Reader's Digest picture of America. The fact that the Reader's Digest invented a post office to mail itself from way back in the 1930s, Pleasantville, New York, I think indicates the kind of America that the Reader's Digest wants to.
It doesn't exist?
What?
Pleasantville, New York?
It does now. That's where all the Reader's Digest employees have to live. But it did not exist before DeWitt Wallace founded it as a post office box number.
Huh.
No, that's his invention. I suppose the first part of the mythologizing. But it seems to me the Reader's Digest mirrors something that runs all the way through American culture that is really strange indeed, and that is that a kind of schizophrenic ideals. Most of us, I think of Americans as having a set of high ideals and then somehow never quite being able to come up to them. But I think instead, if you look at the Reader's Digest and if you look at the rest of pop culture and American lit too, you'll see instead that our problem is not that we don't come up to our ideals, but that we have an almost opposite set of ideals to follow. And we are like the donkey that has an ear of corn in the front and the back. He doesn't know which way to go, and so consequently he simply stands still. What do you find in the Reader's Digest? About half of the articles in the Reader's Digest are articles about how you, if you start out as a newspaper boy and practice all the Ben Franklin virtues, can work your way up to become a president. All you have to do is invent a bigger and better snowmobile. All you have to do is stick to it, be honest, be hardworking, be thrifty, be sort of religious but not fanatic about it, and you too will end in success. That invariably, that gospel of success that Horatio Alger preached and that Ben Franklin preached, is one of the things that the Reader's Digest is all about. Those inspiring biographies of great men who did it in our time, and you can too. But then suddenly, you turn the page, and you hit a whole different kind of article in the Reader's Digest. Those articles that talk about Mad did a great parody of the Reader's Digest once, it had an article called "My Dog Taught Me How to Pray." Which I think are representative of the second kind. The second set of ideals in the Reader's Digest suggest that success in life is not to be found in material wealth or in success or in working hard, but in enjoying your family, in vacationing in your own backyard if you can't afford to go through 2,000 miles to vacation. The best things in life are free. The spiritual rewards of material poverty, how wonderful it is to be poor, how wonderful the Depression was, those kinds of articles. Well, which of those, you see, are we to believe? And I think for most of us, as schizophrenic Americans, these both appeal. We do go out to the woods, we return like Thoreau to Walden Pond, but we do it in big campers and buses and recreation vehicles and so forth and so on. Okay, the Reader's Digest, I think, exemplifies that split, but so does the rest of American literature, because you can trace down from Walden by Thoreau down through much of today's nature writing, and on the other hand, from Ben Franklin down through Horatio Alger, down through Norman Vincent Peale, the gospel of success. Which do we obey, Walden or Thoreau? Is success what Thoreau suggested it is? Thoreau said, and I really like this phrase by Thoreau, the best way to double your income is cut your wants in half. Retreat, live simply. Don't participate in life. Get away from it. Are they my poor? Thoreau says it is most smug in denying any kind of charitable giving. Be your own self. Just get away quietly, pull your beans, and be successful. On the other hand, Ben Franklin is all business. Get up and go. Be successful. Strive. Work hard. The kind of virtues that Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale and others have adopted. And all the way down through our culture, I think, wherever decisions have to be made, you find this divided set of ideals. For instance, in building a road. Is success building Interstate 80 from one end of the country to the other without a stop sign, 8 lanes wide? Or is success doing what Thoreau and the Indians suggested ought to be done, building a path so narrow that only one man can walketh because you disturb nature the least. Is success preserving the environment or building? Take a look at the song we sang the other night. Purple Mountain Majesty's song. And take a look at how schizophrenic the lyrics are in that song. Thine alabaster cities gleam from shore to shore. That echoes Bryant's and Ben Franklin's visions in the early 18th century of a day when there would be no nature left, when the entire continent from California back to Massachusetts would be covered with man's works. How great and how magnificent that is. And I confess that in myself, and I'm sure most of you too, feel these divided set of ideals. There's some, I'm from Illinois, which is partly from Chicago, I guess, and I feel a great pride in the Sears Tower, the tallest building in the world. We finally got it away from New York. But at the same time, I'm really an environmentalist, and I hate that kind of thing. Half of me does. What is success in America? It seems to me not that we have a set of ideals which we don't live up to, but that we're torn two completely opposite ways. We have a kind of schizophrenia about us. Okay, those two myths then that really operate throughout much of our thinking are divided and opposed. The second phenomena that I, or the third phenomena that I'd like to talk about is the whole phenomena of the Western as a literary genre. The Western is far and away the most popular form of entertainment in America, in both movies and in literature. Let me just give you a few facts about the Western. In 1958, these are just because I happen to find statistics for then, I don't think they would vary a great deal now. In 1958, 10.6% of all fiction published in the United States were Westerns. During 1958, 54 feature films put out by Hollywood were Westerns. In 59, 8 of the top 10 TV shows were Western. And 30 of the prime time shows were Western that didn't make it into the top 10. By 1967, this had tapered off a bit, but still, today, 7% of all fiction written in our country is Western. Long after the West has disappeared, long after we've moved into both the atomic and the space age. Why? What is there appealing about the Western that makes us still compulsively come back again and again and again to that form? In Chicago, in a typical week, 16% of the prime time is Westerns. A few of those now have disappeared, and maybe we're moving into a different era, but I suspect we're probably in between. The only person who has sold more novels than Zane Grey, the Western writer, is Mickey Spillane, who has his own kind of mythology going. But Zane Grey has accumulated sales of his novels by now of more than 40 million copies, an incredible number of copies. Zane Grey had one novel or another on the bestseller list constantly from 1917 to 1925. That's how popular the Western is. That is particularly interesting since what we have done is take a period that was actually, I think, quite insignificant in our culture and exploded it into this fantastic thing. So has the rest of the country. If you go over to Germany, you'll find dude ranches where people go for a week and dress up like cowboys and ride horses and learn roping and all that kind of stuff. It's absolutely incredible, this Western phenomenon, particularly since the actual West was a period of 17 years. From the end of the Civil War, which opened up the West, to the coming of the railroad, which brought the towns and civilization and law. The actual West historically was a very brief passing and transitory period in our culture. Those duels that you see on Gunsmoke, that you see in High Noon, that you see in the Virginian, weekly, daily, five or six times, in which two men confront each other at sunup or sundown or high noon or some other symbolic time, that took place by actual historical record, although I would assume there are probably some that didn't get recorded. But that kind of man-to-man confrontation on the streets of Laredo took place historically 5 times. It does that more each day now than it ever did in history. Furthermore,
in the entire history of the West,
the greatest, let me give you another example of the way in which we have distorted and mythologized the West. The famous wagon train battle in which the wagons get into a circle like the elks to protect their young and are surrounded by hundreds of Indians shooting at it and shooting back. Every shot kills 3 Indians and so forth and so on. The longest battle of that kind on record occurred near the Badlands in South Dakota in the mid-1800s. It went on from 5 o'clock in the morning until about 7 o'clock in the evening, and I think the total number of dead on both sides was 3, and the total number of wounded was 8. Those guns weren't accurate. You don't hit an Indian riding 300 feet away, a pony as fast as he could, raising dust. Nor do the settlers get hit very much back of the wagon trains being shot at in the safety of their wagons. It was a fantastically long battle, but it wasn't nearly as destructive. No whole wagon trains were decimated or destroyed in the actual West.
Did you read the book Centennial yet?
No, Michener?
Yeah, so in it he says that the people that came west from the wagon trains had something like 100 times as much chance of being shot by themselves with their own weapons or by one of their neighbors as they were by an Indian on the way.
Yeah, the whole West, I do want to read that book. The whole West is, the West that we see is just an absolute distortion of exaggeration, gross exaggeration of reality. Do you have a...
was thinking that the next thing you're going to tell us is that there was no gunfight at the OK Corral.
There was. But the Earps were as bad as the... it was not so clear who the good guys and bad guys were in that. I mean, the Earps
were hoodlums
as much as the people they shot. I suppose one of the most amazing things, but it's not amazing considering the fact that this is a white culture, is how we have made the West white when in fact it was predominantly black. By some of the most recent counts, and this may itself be an exaggeration, the percentage of black cowboys reached about 70%. Why? Because the slaves had no place to go. They were free, but free for what? They couldn't stay in the South. And so most of them took the meanest, the ugliest, the lowest paying job available, and that was the job of being up there herding those cows. We have in fact taken some great black Western heroes and made them white. Dusky Dick, the demon of Denver, or Deadeye Dick, the dusky demon of Denver, is a good example of a hero that when you see him on television is white, but in fact he was actually black. If you look at photographs of cowboys, you'll find a healthy sprinkling of black ex-slaves among them. But somehow, we have distorted that too. Okay, it seems to me then that wherever we have taken historical fact and so distorted and so blown it out of proportion, something has to be operating back of that to have caused it. What compels us to do that to the West? We have never done it to the Civil War. We haven't done it to World War II. World War II is one of the most strangely silent wars in history. Very few books, aside from Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, and a couple of others have come out of that war. Why? Why have we taken this little 17-year period and just exploded it to the point where our kids still don't play space, they play cowboys and Indians? What is happening? Okay, this is where Leslie Fiedler's thesis comes in, that somehow America was invented before it's discovered. And let me then, as a way of opening the discussion, talk about that. Let's switch quickly from the OK Corral to ancient Babylonia, several thousand years ago, where, for whatever reason, a myth began to develop, and it's one of these first myths. Uses of myth, I think, that I'm talking about. A myth began to develop that as the world moved forward in history and upward in history, it would move west. Somehow, even in ancient Babylonia, the west was a mysterious kind of place. When the world was discovered to be round, again, by the Greeks long before Columbus ever discovered it, this myth took on another proportion. That is, when the circle would be complete, as civilization after civilization populated the earth ever further westward, when the circle would be complete and would reach its origins again, history as we know it would end and a new kind of golden age would dawn, or the end of time would come. There are various mythic suggestions there. As far as history is concerned, history seemed to confirm the idea that as civilization moved westward, it moved upward. Babylonia gave way to Greece, further to the west, which gave way to Rome, a greater civilization, further to the west, and then to Northern Europe, France and Spain, with their great civilizations, and finally to England, with its great, even greater civilization than Greece and Rome. So history seemed to verify this myth that as things moved westward, they moved upward. So that it was only natural then to see America as the next, and of course, because between America and the Orient was the Pacific Ocean, that is, there was no other land before we got back to ancient Babylonia again, it was natural to see the American country and the American people, even before we ever started coming here, as the end of the circle, as not only the highest civilization on earth, but the last civilization that there would be. It is this myth, I think, that led the Puritans, when they came to Massachusetts Bay, it led the Puritans to believe that God was on their side. The Puritans, let me just digress here for a minute, the Puritans, the Puritan concept of history, you can see this in Paradise Lost if you remember it from school. The Puritans believed in a concept of history not as history that moved helter-skelter, but that operated according to a very, very careful plan laid out by God after Adam and Eve fell in the garden. A history that moved in stages, in which God was always more in a certain place in the world than he was in any other place. So that, for instance, in the Old Testament times, he was the Jewish people's God. Then he was the Roman Catholic God. Then he was the Anglican God in England. And the Puritans literally believed when they came to Massachusetts Bay that God was on the boat with them coming over, and that the last battle would be fought in America, and that God had left England and had come over with them. Not that he wasn't concerned about those people, but that history unrolls according to stages, and they were the next act. It's easy to see then, I think, why long before we ever began to be Americans, why the concept of manifest destiny came about. The idea that we are bigger and better, that somehow we are different people. We really are not like any other civilization that had ever existed. The search for a Northwest Passage by Lewis and Clark was not so much economic, I think, as it was an attempt to fulfill this myth. Bryant and Franklin and others who visioned this future of shining cities that would cover the continent, all of this, we were participating under this myth. This myth originally, in the mid-1800s, led settlers to move into farmers to move into Nebraska and Kansas, knowing that there had never been enough rainfall before then to raise the kind of crops they wanted to raise, but confident that because they were moving westward, because they were God's chosen, and because they were destined to complete the circle, that once they moved there, the rain would fall. And when they didn't, and went bankrupt and had to return east, and part of that myth was destroyed for them. Much of what Whitman is doing in Leaves of Grass enhances and participates and perpetuates this myth. In a particular poem, for instance, in Leaves of Grass, Passage to India, Whitman sees this old Babylonian dream, the dream of the prophets, the dream of all of Western civilization to move west, that the dreams of the prophets have finally been made true by American technology and know-how. Particularly, as Whitman is writing Leaves of Grass, three things have happened which have tied the old world to the new world. The Atlantic Cable has just been laid, tying us by telegraph. The Suez Canal has just been built, and the Transcontinental Railroad has spanned the country from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Industry and machinery made by Americans has brought true the old dream of the prophets and poets. And of course, there is Bishop Berkeley's famous poem, "Westward the Course of Empire Takes Its Way." This mystique, in other words, that we have had about the West was a mystique long before there ever was an America discovered. It existed in mythology all the way back and built and grew and was confirmed by history. Furthermore, one of the interesting things about the West, about America before it was discovered by Columbus, was the European concept of direction. Europe, before America, before Columbus, Europeans thought of themselves as inhabiting a world that had only three directions. Why three? The directions were north, south, and east, in a kind of a triangle rather than a polar grid pattern. Why three? The directions were north, south, and east. In a kind of a triangle rather than a polar grid pattern. Europe, Asia, and Libya, there were three continents. There were three sons of Noah that inhabited the three sections of the world. Furthermore, the Trinity, under which most of these Christian historians were operating, believed in three as a fairly magical number. So there was no real place in European thinking for another country to the west. For a country, in other words, like the countries in Europe. This notion, in fact, is pre-Christian. It goes back to the Greek geographer Herodotus. The three royal magicians who come to visit the Christ child come from all three parts of the world. There is no fourth part of the world. There is no America in actuality. There was a west, of course. There was a direction to the west. But in nearly every ancient culture, that direction, or whatever land lay beyond the Atlantic Ocean, was the kingdom of death, or some such thing. The Pope's temporal control over the three parts of the world. St. Augustine argued that because the Pope's mitre had three points, there could be no fourth world beyond the Atlantic Ocean, because it would mean the Pope wasn't in charge over there. If there was a land, says St. Augustine in his famous argument, if there is a fourth quarter of the world beyond the Atlantic Ocean, it could not be a territory for whom inhabited by beings for whom Christ died. And that led St. Augustine to argue that if there is a fourth world, it has to be a supernatural world in the first place, and in the second place, it either has to be inhabited by men who are too bestial to have souls to be saved, or who are too angelic to have souls that needed saving. Either it is a glorious new Eden, or it is a place where devils have given over to the devil. The last thing, and I think this is part of the real problem that Americans have had to face from the Puritans on down to the present, the last thing we expected to find when we came to the new world was just more country like we left, and just more people like the people in Europe. From the very beginning, the Puritans were divided about what the Indians were. The big argument among the Puritans for the first two generations of their existence here was, are the Indians worth saving? Should we bother with saving them? Aren't they too bestial? Or are they too noble, too angelic, too like Adam to need saving? And the result is the Puritans sent out precious few missionaries, because they couldn't quite accept the fact that the Indians were simply human beings. And I think that's precisely the problem that we have with the Indians today. We have spent most of our history thinking of them as beasts, in a way, very little better than beasts, and so we have stuck them on to some of the worst land in the country. They don't really count. They're not human beings the way Americans are human beings. And now, interestingly enough, we've made a shift in the opposite direction. The Indian is somebody to be adored and revered. His way of life is to be held up as a standard for us. We ought to take a look at the way the Indian treats nature, the sacredness with which he does this and that. But somewhere in between, looking at the Indian as a beast or as a noble savage, we have lost the ability to look at him as a person like us. That's, I think, partly because this myth, perpetuated by St. Augustine and others, simply didn't prepare us for finding people over here, or for finding a real land the way we found. Most of the mythologies, then, of European culture saw the West as either a sub- or a superhuman place. To the Greeks, if you read Homer, it was the region of goats, the islands of the blessed by deep eddying ocean. It became, in various other mythologies, Elysium, the Hesperides, the Fortunate Isles, and eventually the earthly paradise. I suppose the most famous use of the West came by the Celts, of King Arthur fame, who lived where Wales is now, on the very west of the known land. The Celts talk about the other place, that place beyond the Atlantic Ocean, and in their later mythology, they come to call it Avalon. And Avalon, remember, if you remember the Arthurian stories, Avalon is the place where King Arthur sleeps amidst the land of apple trees and awaits his second coming. King Arthur will return again someday. C.S. Lewis uses that in That Hideous Strength, the last of his science fiction trilogy. But to the Celts, too, as to all the other Western cultures, what lay beyond the Atlantic Ocean was somehow a mysterious, unreal, supernatural land. The name Columbus itself, ironically, means dove, suggestive of the dove sent forth to discover land after the flood. I could go on and give you any number of examples of the way in which this idea of the West is a mysterious, unreal, beyond human place. Dante assumes that in the Divine Comedy and so forth. So, let me give you one example, though, that I think is particularly apropos. It is commonly believed that, as we're taught in history class, that Columbus thought he landed in India. That's why he called the inhabitants Indians. And that may be true of Columbus's first voyage, but by the time Columbus had made his fourth voyage, even Columbus himself came to believe in the power and the nature of this myth. Columbus really was convinced that he had discovered Eden in the earthly paradise. After his fourth voyage, he wrote a series of letters published as Letters to the Sovereigns, in which he reported back to the people who funded him. He contends, and remember that in the fourth voyage, Columbus landed near Brazil and discovered the mouth of the Orinoco River. Here is what Columbus says about what he thinks he discovered. He says that the Orinoco River, whose mouth he discovered, was actually the Gihon, one of the four rivers which the Bible tells us flows out of Eden, and that the fresh water coming into the salt sea of the Gulf, these are Columbus's words, may well come from paradise. And he ends the letter with this sentence: I deeply feel within me that there, where I have said, lies the terrestrial paradise. Columbus started out thinking he discovered India, but he too ended up thinking that what he discovered was a land unlike any other land in the world, inhabited by people unlike any human being that the world had known. Whether they were better or worse was a toss-up, but they were not real in the way you and I are real. The problem, then, it seems to me, the problem that Americans have had to confront and live with, the problem that has the set of myths that has made us the imperialists that we are, determined to believe that we are the best, determined that our children be better than we are, and that is one of the, I suppose, the most frightening myths perpetuated about America. Somehow a parent isn't a success, is he, until one's child goes above one in life, in fame, or in money, or in position. If a guy's a veterinarian, his kid has to be a medical doctor. If he's a medical doctor, what's left? President? Eventually, you know, you get to an end point, and most parents in America end up frustrated because it can't always keep going up. It's got to go back somehow. But this whole idea of success, the bigger and better, that if New York builds the Empire State Building, we've got to build the Sears Tower in Illinois, and then someplace else has to be build something even bigger and higher than that. All of this, I think, really goes back to this myth that we are a different people. We are Adams and Eves. We are the cowboy out west where never is heard a discouraging word and disguised with our potty all day. We have taken as a result history, we have taken the American Indian and made something just totally fictitious, totally mythical in that first sense of the word myth, out of it. Anyway, this is what Leslie Fever means by the idea that both America and the Indians were invented before they were discovered. And the problems, many of the problems that seem to me permeate our culture, really come from that fact. The result is that we're almost inevitably frustrated at whatever we do. This is neither a howling wilderness, as the Puritans found it, nor is it a new Eden, as Thoreau thought and he could get back to. This is just land like other land, and this is just people like other people. So not only was the myth divided, this kind of schizophrenic double set of ideals, but from the beginning, our actual lives and experiences have never coincided with the dream. We're one of the few great cultures that inherited a great cultural tradition and yet grubbed on the frontier for a living. We're one of the few cultures that came to a land of freedom, from our perspective, yet came as conquerors of the original race. So we're divided then on things worth having, in the same way that the Reader's Digest is. And the Reader's Digest is divided, I think, because it reflects a split in each one of us. We are each really two people drawn in two different ways, and we have trouble getting those halves back together again. We do have the idea, and we still have, I think, that somehow the American is different from any other creature on Earth, that the American experience is somehow unique, it has never happened before on Earth. Not only different, but also better, higher. We are the last great civilization. We have reached the shores of the Pacific Ocean. And I suggest that's one of the reasons why we've taken this relatively insignificant portion of our history, the West, and just blown it up out of all proportion. Taken black cowboys and made them white, taken the gunfight and made it a ritual, and all sorts of things. And still compulsively come back and back and back and again to read Westerns, long after the West has disappeared completely. Are there any questions or comments? Simulating observations or whatever. I really do hate to talk the whole hour. Let me, however, go on talking for another 10 minutes or so and just give you one example of the power that myth has, this kind of myth that I've been talking about, has to distort history. Take the example of the Indian princess. The Indian princess that you see on Land O'Lakes Butter, sitting there kneeling holding butter. That Indian princess was developed very early in our culture. She was portrayed usually as she is on the Land O'Lakes Butter carton, as a handsome, vigorous Indian woman in her 20s of noble visage and bearing, long dark hair, feathered headdress, completely unlike reality. But this cleaned up image of the Indian woman and of the fact that somehow she represents in this myth a confrontation between the white and the Indian. Vine Deloria, whose book Mike is reading, and who graduated from Augustana College and was there a few years ago, talked about how interesting it was that invariably, wherever he goes, he's an Indian, American Indian, wherever he goes, women will come up to him and casually let on that way back they've got Indian princess blood in them. But he says, never, never has a man come up and said, I'm related to an Indian buck. No, the Indian princess is this mysterious kind of thing, beginning with Pocahontas down through Sacagawea and so forth. And let me just use those two as examples. of how we have distorted history. You all know the Pocahontas myth. She is our first mythical Indian woman. She is the subject of innumerable popular plays, poems, novels. She's the one that saved the life of Captain John Smith and ended up marrying him. She put her, as her father was about to, the chief was about to chop Smith's head off, she put her head down and saved him and so forth. That apparently actually happened, but what we have done to Pocahontas herself is really a study in the way in which mythology distorts. Here, for instance, is one of the first of the mythologizings of Pocahontas. The author of Woodman Spare That Tree, George P. Morris, wrote another popular song in which he perpetuates the Pocahontas myth. Here it is, or one stanza from it. Above his head in air the savage war club swung, the frantic girl in wild despair her arms about him flung. Then shook the warriors of the shade like leaves on aspen trees, subdued by the heroic maid who breathed a prayer for him. Unbind him, gasped the chief, it is your king's decree. He kissed away the tears of grief and set the captive free. Tis ever thus when in life's storm hope's star to man grows dim, an angel kneels in woman's form and breathes a prayer for him. One of the most popular plays on the Pocahontas theme is by James Nelson Barker called The Indian Princess or The Beautiful Savage. Has Smith cry out after his rescue, his dramatic rescue by Pocahontas, O woman, angel, sex, where'er thou art, still art thou heavenly, the rudest clime robs not thy glowing bosom of its nature. The real Pocahontas, however, was quite a different kind of girl if you go back into the actual historical records. According to contemporary accounts, popular entertainment for Pocahontas was to have the men in camp, which she frequented with her fellow Indian girls, was to have the men in camp wheel her nude in wheelbarrow fashion all around the camp. And on several occasions, she and the other girls would come into camp naked and attempt to, and actually, I guess, seduce the men on duty who were supposed to be standing watch and just see, you know, how long it would take. The myth of Pocahontas has her converting to Christianity. She never did at all. But we've got to participate in that myth. We've got to exaggerate. The greatest exaggeration, I think, is the famous Lewis and Clark Indian girl, Sacagawea. Sacagawea was, if you've read Donald Colwell Peattie's account of Lewis and Clark, the beloved in an unrequited love affair with Meriwether Lewis. And at the age of 35, he killed himself because the love affair did not work out and so forth. Sacagawea was a beautiful young Indian princess girl who out of noble devotion and out of recognition that the whites were a superior civilization, came and guided Lewis and Clark in throughout the last part of their journey. You probably have been taught in grade school, as I was, that Sacagawea is a beautiful Indian name meaning bird woman. It means, in fact, canoe launcher. But see, that doesn't really fit the myth at all. Not only was she not a beautiful young Indian princess virgin, she was the third wife of a French Canadian who married twice again to different whites in the course of the Meriwether Lewis and Clark trip. There is no indication in the actual journals of either Lewis or Clark that Lewis had any romantic interest, any love interest in her at all, or that his suicide at the age of 35 had anything to do with Sacagawea. But Donald Colwell Peattie, in the most famous account of this love affair, gathered all these myths together. He romanticized Lewis as the eternal, unresting pathfinder, and this is from Donald Colwell Peattie's book. All of it totally mythical in the mythic sense of faith. Beside a man like that, you may always look for a woman. Uniquely, the woman beside Meriwether Lewis was not even of his color. They could not so much as talk together in one tongue, but they lived for one purpose, since her purpose was only his. It was a love as pure and clear and cold as the sources of the Missouri and the Columbia, and out of it has descended to us a mighty flow.
That's not true at all, historically. The myth simply takes over and allows us and forces us to distort history to fit our own needs. At the end of the trail, in Don Coropiti's book, he portrays Sacagawea as an old woman pleading with her people to accept the white man. This is part of that myth of the Indian princess who stands between white civilization and Indian civilization. Always at the end, this takes place in Longfellow's Hiawatha too, always at the end saying, give in to the wiser race, the greater race who is coming to take care of you. Okay, this is Donald Colerose Peaty's quotation of Sacagawea. Listen instead to the white man, he has her say. I have known them long and long. Theirs is the great nation, the greatest. It marches always forward in ways of peace and plenty. I have seen this. Now I have spoken. We could add any number of Indian women to this list of romanticizing mythical Indian women. Red Wing, Minnehaha. The theme of selling out, the theme of giving in to white civilization is also a fairly common one in these mythical stories. Here is Hiawatha's last speech. I am going, O my people, on a long and distant journey, but my guests I leave behind me. Listen to their words of wisdom. Listen to their truth they tell you, for the Master of Life has sent them from the land of light and morning. I don't know exactly how I feel about this myth. I suppose in a way I'm trying to get us as Americans off the hook by suggesting that our problem with the Indian, our problem with ourselves, our problem with our divided sets of ideals, and our distortions of history really began long before there was an America, back in ancient Babylonia. The first Western, in other words, really existed long before there was a West, an actual West, to have. I guess what I'm trying to do is simply show that some of the frustrations that we have really have a mythical base, and to say something about the way in which myth can be used in a bad sense to limit and to distort. Okay, approaching dinner time. Questions, comments, reprisals?
Five, John.
There may have been six or seven. No. By actual count, you know. Yeah. When you stop to think about it, that's a stupid way to have a gunfight, right?
Yeah. Considering the accuracy of an 1845 caliber pistol.
Well, they weren't all that.
Just stand there and reload a couple of times, knock the guy down.
I suppose most of our idea of the West, one of the reasons for the popularity of the West, and I could give you a whole nother hour on Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill was one of the only two men in American history who've been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor and had it taken away when it was discovered that the whole thing was all fake. Buffalo Bill was never anybody in the West except for 1,000 buffalo shots in a period of 3 days once. But the dime novel picked him up and made a hero out of him on a dare, and by the end of his life, even Buffalo Bill began believing a lot of the things he did. The Wild West show was a total fake. The reason he could shoot those clay pigeons so well in the tent was that he used birdshot in his pistol. It was hard to miss.
There was a fun movie on. Did you see that last winter? He was a character.
No, I didn't.
Bill Cody, and Clem Eugene and Wild West are showing them as. Mostly a lot of talk. I mean, it probably had no historical accuracy.
I think
it was really fun.
Calamity Jane apparently was really very good as a writer and a trick shot artist, but Buffalo Bill was not at all. I mean, his whole life was a sham. Cummings has a beautiful poem on Buffalo Bill that is simply called Portrait. It's only about five lines long. And it begins with the lines, Buffalo Bill defunct. And that's just beautiful because that's precisely what a guy who never was alive is allowed to do. if you never were alive, if you were a sham your whole life, you can't die. People die. Institutions and machines go defunct. And that really is all Buffalo Bill ever was an institution. Not allowed the dignity of death by coming, but of simply becoming defunct.
How does then the Eastern culture fit into
America? You mean Oriental?
Yeah.
not hardly at all. I mean, to say that when you reach the shore of the Pacific Ocean, you've completed the circle, you have to overlook about 10,000 years of great, great civilization, which we are perfectly capable of doing and have done.
According to Michener in his book, a great many of the cattle ranches in the West for that period of time were actually owned and operated by English capital, because during that period of time the banking system and the tight money markets, American capital was not available. So actually, what they had was, the sons of the cartels or some business enterprise, whether it's corporation or not, I don't know. Joint money investment would come over, and these big spreads of ranches were really English ranches.
That sounds like a fairly accurate book. I mean,
is that true?
Yeah.
I think he does his research pretty well.
Sounds that way.
Yeah. What about the massacre of the Indians by the white? He goes into a...
That's all real.
That's all real. He talks about the Arapaho development of the Fort Laramie. He traces... he goes a long way. But
we slaughtered them partly because they really weren't human. So it didn't make much difference what we did to them. They looked human enough to make us uncomfortable at times, but I think deep down we never really have accepted them as humans. Now they're angels.